From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. President's Club is a term that screams elitism. President's Clubs are in airport lounges. They're the titles of organizations of people who want to sound important. But there's also a more literal President's Club, made up of our actual presidents. Journalists Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy have traced the relationships of presidents since World War II. These men were rivals and unlikely allies as they helped each other through some of the nation's most trying times. Gibbs and Duffy spoke at Seattle's town hall on May 11th, 2012.
Thank you.
Thank you all for coming.
Nancy and I do this sort of back and forth because we have a lot of things we want to show you that we've pulled from the Time Life photo archive to describe this book. And the quick explanation of it goes like this. We all love reading presidential biographies, whether it's Edmund Morris on Teddy Roosevelt or David McCulloch on Truman or even Bob Caro on Johnson. But we rarely look at the men, so far only men, together because relationships we all know in our lives matter. So we thought if we lined them up next to each other and see how what sparks and friction and things happen, we'd both understand them better as presidents, we'd learn something about the presidency itself, and we also might learn something about why our politics it works or doesn't work. The other thing we discovered is that while we began talking about this book together 4 or 5 years ago as the club, the club of people who had had the office, what we didn't expect to find is it actually is a club. It's not just a construct or an idea. It's a real thing, a real bricks and mortar thing. And though it started way back in the 1950s and even earlier, it actually still exists today.
I want to take you back to long, long before anyone in this room was born, which is 1945, which is when this picture was taken. And it's extraordinary because it sort of marks the founding moment of the modern President's Club. You could argue that George Washington really established the President's Club by deciding to become an ex-president, to leave office rather than serve as president for life, which he easily could have. But we decided to focus on the post-war years, because it's during that time that the presidency in its impact changes, and the impact that former presidents can have changes dramatically as they begin living longer, living larger, being able to travel the world as emissaries for presidents. And all of that begins with this unbelievably unlikely partnership of Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover. Truman, as you know, takes office suddenly upon Roosevelt's death in May of 1945, or in April of 45, and among the many crises he is facing is the fact that Europe is so devastated by war that literally millions and millions of people are at risk of starving to death in the months ahead because agriculture has been destroyed, transportation has been destroyed, and Truman is worried about a civilian catastrophe coming on the heels of this long military ordeal. And no one in the world knows more about feeding hungry people than Herbert Hoover. He had done it for Woodrow Wilson during World War and after World War I. And all through the war, people had urged Franklin Roosevelt, you know, you should call Hoover. He can help with humanitarian relief. You should call Hoover. And FDR would say about that pariah who had been exiled from Washington, I am not Jesus Christ. I am not raising Herbert Hoover from the dead. Truman didn't feel that way. Truman secretly mails a letter to Hoover, saying he doesn't secretly because he knows that everyone in the Roosevelt White House would be appalled at this idea, but saying, can you come in and talk to me? And so the two men meet when this picture is taken. And Truman basically says, can you help me figure out, you are an engineer. This is a huge global puzzle. How do we get the food from the countries that have it to the countries that need it? The two men have a very interesting conversation. They go their separate ways. Hoover doesn't think anything is really going to come of this. Within a year, Truman has given him a staff and a plane and sent him to 22 countries, 50,000 miles around the world. He meets with 36 prime ministers, 7 kings, and the Pope in the course of liberating surplus food from countries that could spare it to countries that needed it. And so you could argue that what these two very strange bedfellows managed to accomplish together through that mission and some that followed probably saved more lives than any two men in the 20th century, which is why when they meet each other on the platform at Eisenhower's inauguration in 1953, Hoover goes over to greet Truman and says, I think we should form a president's club. Truman says, great, you be the president, I'll be the secretary. And that is sort of, you know, the creation myth, except for the fact that with each passing year and each passing president, the club becomes more real. It starts out as sort of a fun idea between these two guys that they're joking. But by 1957, Eisenhower has granted them office privileges and mailing rights and a pension. Lyndon Johnson comes into office and gives them Secret Service protection and the use of White House helicopters and planes and even a projectionist so they can watch movies from the White House film library when they're in Washington. If they're being treated at Walter Reed, they can check out movies and screen them. Each president adds a little more to it. I think the president who probably made the President's Club most real was Richard Nixon.
This is a house on Lafayette Square, which is unmarked. It's four stories, brownstone, built in about 1870. And it's called Trowbridge House. And no one lives there. It is one of the nicest four-star hotels I have ever seen. It might be a five-star hotel. But it is also the official, and I mean official, Washington residence of all the former presidents. Now, I didn't know this building existed. I didn't know this facility existed until I was talking to a former aide to one of the presidents who told me that in 1969 he was working for Richard Nixon. And Nixon had been president about a year, and Nixon had it up to here with Lyndon Johnson, who had retired to the Texas Hill Country, calling every couple of days saying, I want to come to Washington, I want a plane, I want a place to work, I want a place to stay, can you get me a hotel room, I need a car. And LBJ was like that. He was constantly needing things. And Nixon had, while he had his issues with Johnson, he didn't want him to be unhappy. So he said to this young aide, will you find me a place to put him? And so the young aide, who was an Air Force colonel by the name of Brent Scowcroft, in his first White House job, there would be others that follow, scarfs around, calls the GSA, and comes up with this building on Lafayette Square. The official address is 716 Jackson Place on the east side. And they take this hulk of a building and turn it into not much more than a couple of rooms and a bath. It's about four doors down from Pennsylvania Avenue. You really have to look for it to find it. It's a little bit like that house in, what's the house in Harry Potter that comes out of, just appears magically? Grimold Place. It's a little like Grimold Place. There's nothing on the door. Anyway, no reporter, as I know, had ever gotten into it until about 3 weeks ago when I went in with Bill Plant of CBS, who was doing a thing on the book. And this is the first picture. It has a couple of, on the first floor, there's a sitting room and an office. On the second floor, there are these two dining rooms. On the third floor, there's weirdly, a standalone bathtub. I don't know why that's there. It's just been renovated. It's really nice. And I got to tell you, the thread count on the sheets now, it's like a gajillion thread counts. This is the seal on top of the bed. Again, no one's really seen these before. So that if you are a former president and you wake up in, you know, Trowbridge House because you're using it, you can look down at your feet and say, oh, yeah, I used to be president. Very few people can check in, only five people, and you have to do it with the White House.
So one thing that we found as we watched this club take on greater and greater meaning was that presidents from different parties had a way of getting along better than presidents from the same party. And in virtually every case, the bond was able to transcend personality, transcend politics, transcend generation, all of which were true with these two presidents, is the bond of sympathy that comes from just having to do an impossible job. Kennedy and Eisenhower did not have much use for each other. Going into the 1960 election, Eisenhower would point in the Oval Office to his chair and say, damn it, I don't want to see Jack Kennedy sitting in that chair. But once Kennedy is elected, who Eisenhower used to call Little Boy Blue, Eisenhower is intent on seeing him succeed. It's not because he favored anything that Kennedy was pushing. It's because Eisenhower thought in dangerous times, it is very important that the United States presidency is strong and effective. And so when, 4 months into Kennedy's first term, the Bay of Pigs invasion in Cuba goes so disastrously wrong, Kennedy calls up Eisenhower, says, can you come see me? And the two men go to Camp David together. Camp David, named after Eisenhower's grandson, David, a place Kennedy, at the time this picture was taken, had never been. Eisenhower shows him around for the first time and pretty much almost literally takes him to the woodshed about everything that had gone wrong in the planning and execution of the Bay of Pigs invasion. It's a rough conversation. It is very tough about how Kennedy had made decisions and how many dissenting views he had heard and how he had changed the plans as it had evolved. And at one point, Kennedy says to him, "No one knows how tough this job is until you've been in it for a few months." And Eisenhower says, "Forgive me, Mr. President, I tried to tell you that a few months ago." And it is that sympathy and that understanding that comes through again and again, because after their private conversation, when Eisenhower faces reporters, all he has to say to them at this moment of sort of humiliation for a young American president was, "It is the responsibility of every American to support their president, and that's what I intend to do." And a week later, when a Republican congressional delegation comes to see Eisenhower at his farm, he says, "I don't want any witch hunting. We need to put this behind us. We need to move forward." And all of this is in the interests of making sure that this terrible episode does not weaken the United States at a time when he thought would be disastrous for the country's national security. Even closer is the relationship that develops between these two men, between Eisenhower and Johnson. Literally on the night that Kennedy is assassinated, Johnson calls Eisenhower, whom he had known for years. He was the Senate Majority Leader during Eisenhower's presidency. These two guys had done a lot of deals together. They didn't particularly trust each other. They knew each other very well. But this was, again, a true moment of national emergency. And Johnson says, "I have needed you for a long time. I need you more than ever now." The next day, Eisenhower gets in his car, drives to Washington, comes to see Johnson at the White House, writes out in longhand on a legal pad, "Here's what you need to say to a joint session of Congress at this moment. The world is watching. The country is watching. It's very important that you signal stability." And he basically said, "The best thing you could do is to promise to work as hard as you can to enact your slain predecessor's program." This was not because Eisenhower wanted to see Kennedy's program enacted. It's because he thought that what the country needed at that moment was that promise of continuity and of stability. And all through Johnson's presidency, he would call Eisenhower, say, "Can you come see me? Can you slip into Washington?" There were times when he was wrestling with what to do in Vietnam that Johnson turned meetings over to Eisenhower to run. It's almost unimaginable now, when we think about how our political conversation goes, how close these two were. And at one point, the club has souvenirs. Johnson gives Eisenhower a pair of cufflinks with a presidential seal on them. And he says, "You know, you and Harry Truman are really the only two guys who can legitimately wear these." He says, "You notice it doesn't say Democrat or Republican on them."
One of our other favorite examples of cross-party pollinization is Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford, pictured here with Richard Nixon on the famous flight to Cairo in October 1981, when Ronald Reagan sends them over to the funeral of Anwar Sadat. There was some confusion about when that trip began. Secret Service made sure that all three former presidents landed at Andrews Air Force Base within 1 minute of each other, arriving in order of protocol, which in this case was Carter first, then Ford, then Nixon, because the most recent president is the one who has the highest rank. They all three go to Cairo. What unfolds is one of the most unlikely friendships in the entire book, between Jimmy Carter and the man he beat, Gerald Ford, in 1976. They were united on the way back by their shared unhappiness with having to raise money for their libraries and their shared dislike of Ronald Reagan. Over the next 25 years, Ford and Carter would go on to do about 25 projects together, some very public, some private, some at home, some overseas. Budgets, deficits, arms control, Middle East peace, election monitoring all over the world. They got so close that each vowed to give the eulogy of the other when he died, whoever would go first. And it would be Carter's job to do that when Ford died in 2006. Ford once said that he came to like Carter so much that he was very sad whenever one of them had to get out of the limousine to go home. Again, a real surprise for men who had fought bitterly in 1976. This is one of maybe the most unlikely combinations of friends and partners. This is a buddy movie Hollywood is yet to make. In 1993, Bill Clinton is elected president, and the day he is sworn in, there are five living former presidents: Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush. All of them wanted to help Clinton. They all were kind of intrigued by Clinton. Even Bush, who Clinton beat, wanted Clinton to succeed, leaving him a note saying, "I'll be rooting for you." But no one wanted Clinton's attention quite like Nixon, who practically stood on Pennsylvania Avenue and waved his hands, "Call me, call me, call me, call me." Because, of course, Nixon was on his, you know, 20-year redemptive tour, and it was nearly done. Nixon sends Clinton a series of letters in private and public, at once cajoling and threatening, saying, "Call me, or these, I'm going to go public with some of my concerns." Finally, Clinton does call him. And over the course of 1993, these two men become late-night phone pals, talking about China and Russia, and Clinton's pressing Nixon in some of these calls, just, "How do you do this job? How do you organize your day? What did you eat? When did you nap? When did you go to bed?" And Nixon's fascinated by the fact that Clinton's trying to figure it out, because he remembers that when he was president, he couldn't figure it out and wanted to talk to Ike about it. So the torch is passed to a new generation. And when Nixon dies in April 1994, about a year and a half later from... about a year after this meeting in the White House, Clinton gives a eulogy for Nixon, which tries to reposition Nixon not as a failed president, but as a moderate Republican. Because, of course, he's facing new threats from the right wing of the Republican Party, and he wants to make Nixon more of a hero. When we talked to Clinton last fall about his relationship with Nixon, he couldn't stop talking. And he told us that he got a letter from Nixon about a month before he died that he says was one of the shrewdest, smartest things I ever got as president, and that he still takes it out and rereads it once a year.
Michael Duffy and Nancy Gibbs, journalists and the authors of The President's Club, inside the world's most exclusive fraternity. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 11th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of their talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Heidi Lang recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy in a moment. 824, 94.9 KUOW. A Canadian senator cited a certain American charity as an example of how foreigners are trying to influence Canadian policy. An official of that charity responds. Also, Irish poet Seamus Heaney accepts a Lifetime Recognition Award by the Griffin Trust for Excellence in Poetry. And a First Nations representative responds to Enbridge's claim that 60% of First Nations groups along the Northern Gateway oil pipeline route have signed up to share in profits. All three of these items tonight at 11. Lows around 50 tonight, showers likely. Friday highs mid to upper 50s, showers likely.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Harry Truman and Herbert Hoover were from opposing parties. But when Truman took office after Franklin Roosevelt's death, he needed some advice, and he and Hoover became unlikely friends. This was the start of the President's Club, a shadow organization that began as a joke. These private relationships and rivalries among the most powerful men in the country are documented in Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy's new book, The President's Club: Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. Gibbs and Duffy trace the evolution of the President's Club from the end of World War II to Barack Obama. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 11th, 2012.
Now, of all the remarkable relationships we've seen, you know, politics is complicated. Family is even more complicated. And the idea of seeing a father and a son in the office, you know, in our lifetimes is an extraordinary thing. This picture is taken on the day that George W. Bush is inaugurated, and the moment is so emotional for both men, they said they could barely speak to be back in the Oval Office. Any number of books and treatises and doctoral dissertations have and will be written about this relationship and what it meant. And they typically tend to focus on how the father-son relationship affected the second Bush presidency. I think maybe the more relevant, intriguing question is how the presidency affected the father-son relationship. Because what we found is that both presidents know that every president has no shortage of advisors, no shortage of people there to suggest what to do in different courses of action. You only have one dad. And that what President Bush 43 needed in the White House was his father, as a father, not as a counselor, not as a puppeteer, not as an advisor. And so this remarkable thing happens between the two men where the senior President Bush is so worried about the burden his son faces because he knows, as only a former president can know, he has the worries of a father, but he has the knowledge of a president about what it is like to be ordering troops into battle, to be confronting the kinds of challenges that President Bush faced. And so he's so worried about what this is going to do to his son. And of course, the criticism of the policy is weighs so heavily, so much more heavily on the father than on the son, that the son starts calling him up and saying, "Dad, you've got to stop reading the papers. Turn off the television. I'm fine. Don't worry about me." And as remarkable as it is to see an actual father and son, it's even more remarkable that that father also had a surrogate son in the White House.
One of my favorite stories in the club is that in sometime around 2005, Bush 2, 43, taps these two men to solve the problem of what to do about private relief, first in Asia after the tsunami there, and then later in Katrina in the Gulf Coast. Clinton, of course, beat Bush in 1992. Bush was devastated by that defeat. And yet over the course of the next couple of years, he begins to reach out to Clinton, and Clinton is quite anxious to have a friend, as all new presidents are. This relationship has deepened into something that is quite real and quite genuine, so much so that Clinton now invites himself to Kennebunkport for vacation. And when Betty Ford died last summer, Clinton wanted to escort Barbara Bush. I mean, it really is kind of like Barbara O'Shea. There's a familial relationship now developing inside the club that's quite complicated with, you know, Bush 41, his real son, and then his surrogate son, or as the Bush family calls Clinton, brother from another mother.
Now, lest we leave the impression that this is entirely sweetness and light and comedy inside this fraternity, they have seen no small share of fights and feuds and sabotage and blackmail and all of the complicated relationships that you might imagine when you have men with outsized egos and agendas and ambitions and missions that they want to accomplish. But again, the battles sometimes are political, but the battles are also sometimes very personal, as is the fascinating case between these two men. So Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower, who work so closely together in the years immediately following the war, trying to demobilize and reorganize the armed forces, trying to ensure stability in Europe, trying to create a global security infrastructure, especially with the founding of NATO. The two men are comrades in arms, to the point that in 1948, Truman says to Eisenhower, "You know, if you want to run, I'll get out of the way. I'll even be your vice president if you want." By 1952, when Eisenhower does run, and Truman initially, who's not running for re-election, is very supportive. He says he's a fine fellow. Of course, Truman intended to support Adlai Stevenson, but he had nothing bad to say about Eisenhower heading into that election. Until a moment that summer when Eisenhower is campaigning in Wisconsin with Joe McCarthy and decides to drop from his speech what would have basically been a denunciation of McCarthy's tactics. Truman was horrified by this. How did Truman know? Because unfortunately for Eisenhower, the New York Times had a copy of Eisenhower's original speech and published the fact that Eisenhower had gone to Wisconsin planning to criticize McCarthy and then had decided not to. And Truman considered this an act of moral cowardice. And he said to people, "You know, I knew him, of Eisenhower. I trusted him. I thought he would be a good president. But he has betrayed every principle I thought he stood for. And he's unfit for the office." It was very tough. And he campaigned around the country just eviscerating Eisenhower. to the point that when Eisenhower goes on to win in a landslide anyway, he is so angry that he initially, on Inauguration Day, refuses to come to the White House to pick up Truman. Really, really frosty relations that day. And they continue throughout Eisenhower's presidency. He has no desire to consult with Truman on anything, no desire to bring him in on barely so much as a birthday card. And yet, because of the nature of the sort of winding road these relationships take, the two men find themselves sort of thrown together in, of all places, the backseat of a limousine, riding home from Arlington Cemetery after the burial of John F. Kennedy in 1963. And they start talking about their own burial plans and assassination attempts. And in that shadow of their mortality, of course, smaller things fall away. And towards the end of the ride, Truman turns to Ike and says, "You want to come up for a drink?" Eisenhower, "Sure." And they go in, and the two men talk the night away. And that's how they reconcile. These two men would not reconcile. These two men, two of the master gamesmen ever to occupy the presidency, Richard Nixon, Lyndon Johnson, do battle across 5 years, two elections, three continents over literally the stakes of war and peace, life and death. And it begins with the 1968 campaign. Johnson, remember, has said he's not going to run for re-election in 1968. All he wants is to leave office as a peacemaker. And so the peace talks for Vietnam are going on in Paris. And in the very final days of the 68 campaign, Johnson learns through some very sensitive intelligence sources that Nixon's people are sabotaging the peace talks in order to prevent a breakthrough that might have tipped that election to Hubert Humphrey. That Nixon's people are basically telling the South Vietnamese, don't agree to any deals, you'll do better when Nixon's in office. Walk away, don't do it. In the end, that election was extremely close. And Johnson had a choice to make about whether to confront and challenge Nixon publicly about what he was privately calling treason. It was 1968. Bobby Kennedy had been killed. Martin Luther King had been killed. Chicago had erupted in riots. There was only so much a country could take. And Johnson decided not to confront him over it. That was the first remarkable showdown. It was matched only by what happened 4 years later, after Nixon. Now you understand why Nixon was so eager to keep Johnson happy, to buy the clubhouse, to personally plan Johnson's 61st birthday party, to name a redwood grove after Lady Bird, to do anything he could to keep Johnson quiet and content. 1973 comes. Nixon's been reelected in a landslide. Watergate is nipping at his heels. The Senate is starting its investigation plans. Nixon's men call Johnson down in Texas and say, you need to tell your Senate friends to back off on this Watergate investigation, or else we'll reveal that you were illegally eavesdropping on us back in 1968. At which point Johnson says, and then I'll reveal what I learned when I illegally eavesdropped on you back in 1968. So you say, well, how is it that didn't all blow up at the time? It didn't all blow up at the time because Nixon's inaugurated on January 20th, and on January 22nd, Lyndon Johnson dropped dead of a heart attack. And now there is no club. There are no living presidents left other than Richard Nixon.
Fast forward 25 years, maybe a little longer. Here we are in 2005. Two presidents who had actually a pretty good start and then also came apart. And you can kind of see the look on George Herbert Walker Bush's face about how he feels about the man to his left. Having covered Bush for 4 years, I can tell you what he's thinking is, get me out of here. When Bush comes into office, he actually puts Carter to work on some stuff. He sends him to Nicaragua. He sends him to Panama to unravel some political problems with dictators there. And Carter does a great job. He nails both of the assignments perfectly. He does it creatively. He does it in a way that gets Bush out of some political trouble. And then they come apart. And they come apart in 1990 when Bush, mounting the first Gulf War, creates this massive global coalition to oust Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. And, everyone's in this party. I mean, Syria's part of it. Egypt's part of it. I mean, you were just left out if you were not part of that coalition. You were really, even the Russians were involved. The Chinese were for it. The Japanese paid for it. It was just great. The war lasted what? A couple of hours? I don't know. With about 4 weeks to go, Carter mounts a personal letter-writing campaign to unravel the coalition. He writes first to the UN Security Council members and says, Bush is going to go too far with this war. He's going to go beyond Kuwait. He's going to go all the way to Baghdad. And he writes all the... And the White House finds out about this letter-writing campaign and tells them to stop because they know... This is borderline treason now, because you're basically against the Logan Act, an old law which says no person, individual person, private person can basically conduct a private foreign policy. Does Carter stop? No. He mounts a second letter-writing campaign, this time to members of the Arab League. This is Jimmy Carter's problem in general in the President's Club. He basically thinks he's smarter than everyone else. He has often said that he's a better ex-president than he was president. Well, that's kind of obvious. But he also tends to say things like this: I feel that my role as a former president is probably superior to that of other former presidents. So that hasn't earned him a lot of friends. This is another partnership that is nothing but, if not rocky. Just check out the body language here. This is really, the handshake alone tells you all you need to know. That is the non-handshake. That is a handshake which is, this is all you get. And the eye contact really works here for me too. Yeah. These are two men who fought like ferrets in 2008 when Hillary Clinton was running for president. Obama made Bill the reason not to vote for Hillary for most of 3 or 4 months. He wrote in his book, The Audacity of Hope, that Obama had had a small presidency, full of small things, and that he was personally too flawed really to conduct the kind of transcendent presidency that he himself would conduct. Clinton looked at Obama and said, I think the word was, he called him a fairy tale. And there were other things said by aides which were far worse. When Obama finally beats Hillary and goes on to beat John McCain in the fall, and Hillary is named Secretary of State, Obama essentially makes Bill Clinton sign a prenup. The prenup says basically this: if your wife is going to be Secretary of State, then it's an 8-point agreement, memorandum of agreement between these two men of all the things Bill could and couldn't do, could say and could not say, go and could not go, where he could raise money and could not raise money. It was a prenup. For the next couple of years, they kind of edged around each other. There's really no love lost, but they're, of course, you've noticed, probably beginning to see more of each other. If you've seen Obama's rather remarkable 17-minute video about his reelection, who appears more than Obama? Clinton, 4 times in 17 minutes. Who makes the closing arguments? Clinton. Who was then drawn from that video just last week in the second Obama video about the bin Laden raid? Clinton, who is now appearing with Obama in 3 fundraisers over the next 2 weeks. Clinton. So they're trying to find a partnership now, and that story continues to unfold.
So the thing that struck us, as much as the personal tensions and consolations and intimacy that developed between these two men, is that well, that's fine and that's helpful and that's interesting for them, but there is actually a larger purpose that also keeps coming through. And it starts with back with our two founders, which has to do with not the presidents, but the presidency itself. And a conviction shared particularly by men who've occupied the office that the office needs to be protected. It's almost as though the club functions as a kind of shadow secret service, protecting the presidency, and protecting the presidency regardless of who is in the office at any given time. And it starts with Truman and Hoover chairing the Hoover Commission, whose job was basically to reinvent the presidency for the modern age, for the nuclear age, for the challenges that presidents after the war were going to be facing. The executive office, the government was a mess. It had grown so big so fast that, you know, a single salmon swimming upstream to spawn would come under the jurisdiction of 12 different federal agencies. Hoover does this unbelievable job investigating everything and making proposals about how to reorganize the executive branch, which Democrats thought was insane. Why do you put a conservative Republican who hated everything about the New Deal in charge of potentially dismantling the entire infrastructure that the New Deal had created? And the reason Truman trusted him to do it is because he understood, in a way very few people did, that Hoover had been president during a national emergency and knew what it was like not to have the tools he needed to address it. And so these two men work together to reinvent the presidency itself. Then you have Hoover and Eisenhower working together to protect the office in a different way after the 1960 election, where this photograph of Richard Nixon greeting the man who had so narrowly beaten him and who many Republicans were charging had stolen the election, greeting him down in Florida a few days after the election, both Eisenhower and Hoover, in phone calls 15 minutes apart one night, told Nixon, "Don't challenge the results. I think we're in enough trouble in the world today," Hoover says. "Some indications of national unity are essential. The rest of the world needs to see America moving forward peacefully in a peaceful transition, and the disruption of that kind of a challenge would be very destructive." We see it again when Gerald Ford decides, against certainly his own political interest, to pardon Richard Nixon, a decision that arguably cost Ford his own chance at being elected in 1976, but which he absolutely believed was necessary for the country to have any chance of moving forward in 1974.
And Ford would come back and play a similar role, very little known, in 1998, when he saw another president, again, this is 25 years later, who was about to be impeached. Bill Clinton faced impeachment, was impeached, then faced a Senate trial. At about that point, Ford swings into action, begins a campaign both in public and in private to steer the impeachment off course and arrange for some kind of censure, short of impeachment. Again, not so much to protect Clinton, but to protect the presidency. He thought it was already had been weakened in the 25 years since he had served. He didn't want to see it further weakened. He tries to convince Clinton and his men to take a deal, short of impeachment. And at one point, Ford and Clinton are on the phone all the time trying to figure out. He's literally trying to personally negotiate a third way out of this. At one point, Carter even joins this effort. So the club is really weighing in behind the scenes on impeachment. This picture is actually from an award that Clinton gave Ford about a year later. The key moment in the conversations, the negotiations between Ford and Clinton, Ford says to Clinton, "You just have to admit that you lied." And Clinton, that's a deal that Clinton was not willing to take. One of my favorite moments in the club's role of protecting the presidency, a little bit offbeat but interesting nonetheless, is this meeting between two men who most people probably don't think ever met. And they, in fact, had only met twice, once before in 1983 and here in 1992, right after Clinton is elected. He's in L.A. He pays a courtesy call on the 40th president, who by then is 81, has not yet talked about Alzheimer's, and that would be 3 years later, 2 years later. He goes up and visits him, and he asks Reagan, "Do you have any advice for me?" And Reagan says, "First, you ought to get to Camp David. It's a great place. It'll be good for your soul." And the other thing he says, "You know, I've been watching you on the campaign trail, and I got to say, you know, I've seen you salute, and it's really wimpy. It's just kind of pathetic salute. If you're going to be president, you've got to do it sharp. You've got to bring it up slow and shake it off fast." And Reagan had this keen perception, exquisite, really, understanding of how perception, the role that plays in leadership, whether you're in government or business or wherever. And he was basically saying to the new guy, "You can't just do this the way you want. You've got to kind of, you know, take the role seriously." And so the two men sit there and practice their salutes.
Which brings us to the present moment and the most recent club meeting. This doesn't happen very often, but shortly after President Obama's election, George W. Bush assembled the entire membership for lunch and said what amounts to sort of a club protocol when he says, "We want you to succeed. All of us, Democrat or Republican, know that the office transcends the individual." And I think if there's a lesson that we've taken away from this is what does it take in order for men of vast differences, politically, personally, generationally, to find common cause in some larger purpose. It does not require them to put aside their principles or to suppress disagreements or to pretend that they all get along perfectly. They don't. And yet again and again and again, we saw a willingness to do something difficult together for the good of the country. It is actually possible. There is a model for it. And at a time when we're having a conversation about what that looks like, that's what it can look like.
Thank you very much.
Michael Duffy and Nancy Gibbs, journalists and the authors of The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 11th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of their talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Heidi Lang recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy in a moment, 8:46, 94.9 KUOW. NPR Chief Executive Gary Nell talks about the future of public radio tonight at midnight. Weather outlook for tonight, lows around 50, showers likely. Friday highs mid to upper 50s, and showers likely. A look at an experimental school at the University of Washington where children with disabilities interact with their typically developing peers to learn basic skills like talking, counting, and playing. Also, John Marsliff and Tony Angel talk about their book, Gifts of the Crow, how perception, emotion, and thought allow smart birds to behave like humans. And University of Washington audiologist Kelly Tremblay talks about why hearing loss occurs and what can be done about it. All three of these items next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. What types of relationships do ex-presidents have? And what happens behind the scenes when presidents meet each other? Journalists Nancy Gibbs and Michael Duffy spent years conducting interviews and investigating the President's Club, a camaraderie of the most powerful men in the United States. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 11th, 2012. Next, they take questions from the audience.
Two questions. One is, how did you find out about all these private conversations? And then you alluded to a letter that Clinton takes out and reads to himself. Can you tell us what's in it?
You want to take both or first? Or?
Well, how we found out, this is a marvelous time to be interested in presidents and the presidency. And it's a great time to be journalists. And so what we did was a combination of the kind of historical detective work that historians do and the kind of normal legwork that journalists do. The presidential libraries are fantastic resources. In some cases, we were able to have access to letters that had not been published before amongst these men. And the presidents themselves, after some negotiation over quite a period of time, I think it may be too much to say that they were willing to have this story be told, but the fact that they cooperated with us, and President Carter, President Bush, President Clinton, all spoke with us about these relationships and what they had meant to them and how it had affected them. I think maybe they recognize, and Clinton at least has said this, that the country kind of likes seeing them work together, that they know that we're supposed to disagree, we're supposed to argue with each other, that's all fine, but at some point they also like seeing people from different parties put their disagreements aside to get something done. And I think that may have been one of the reasons they were willing to talk to us.
The mysterious seven-page, single-space type letter from Richard Nixon to Bill Clinton, which I did try to get for most of the 3.5, 4.5 years that we've been working on this, I was unable to obtain. I have several theories as to why. He has let it be quoted in a couple of places, and so we picked up those quotes. We talked to him, Clinton, about the letter, and he was very good when he talked to us. He was able to quote from it. Why hasn't it been released? I can only guess. One is that Clinton's papers are a mess still. I'm sure they want to release things in a certain order, and these kinds of letters tend to come late. This letter was written in April 1994. This is why I think it hasn't been released, but it's just a guess on my part. I think by then Ken Starr had been named special prosecutor. So here is Richard Nixon, a man who had faced his own suite of special prosecutors, writing to Bill Clinton, not the first president to face a special prosecutor, but one with whom he had become close. I'm guessing there may be something in there about special prosecutors and how to handle them that Clinton is not ready to release. One of the things we discovered by talking to all the presidents is you can interview them. That doesn't mean they'll tell you the truth. And you sometimes find that what they tell you is a little bit of a rewrite of what really happened. That wasn't the case in this round of interviews. But Clinton, Carter was excellent. George Herbert Walker Bush, who we did by email because he's really good on email, was really wonderful. So we had good luck. But I'm guessing as to why.
Thank you. This has just been wonderful. The big history and the touches both at both levels. Since you finished your book, a large controversy has come out now about how much money we give to ex-presidents, how much we support them. In general, what's your view about that, and should we change it?
I don't really have a view. Do you have a view?
No, I think, you know, how much money as sort of as taxpayers, I mean, those pensions tend to have been, you know, for most of American history, there was no support at all. And in fact, Harry Truman, I mean, Hoover didn't have a problem. He was independently wealthy. Truman could barely afford the stamps to answer all the mail he was getting. So it was quite an issue for him, which was one of the reasons why instituting a pension was a priority.
The perks now, not the pension, but the perks.
The overall perks.
The perks are hundreds of millions of dollars.
I don't think it's that much. I'd be very surprised if it's more than $20 million at the most. But that's bupkis. That's bupkis. It's nothing. And, you know, we subject these men to lifelong risks and their families. They come out of the office bearing impossibly large scars for the trouble of trying to get help us to go in one direction or another direction. You know, stamps, Secret Service agents, surely we wouldn't begrudge them protection. These men will be targets for the rest of their lives. Their families don't get much protection. They're targets. I mean, I live on a street with, you know, and I'm not that far outside of Washington with, you know, practically everyone on the street is in some, you know, position of exposure and authority, you know, I don't think this is an issue that we would, on balance, take away. I think it's probably, I guess that is my view. I guess I do have a view. I think I should stop talking.
In your endeavors to write this book, which president was the most helpful or cooperative, and which president was the least helpful or cooperative?
Well, you know, the most helpful, Clinton, as you might imagine, is a great talker. But what was striking with him was, you know, to go into his office in Harlem, and one of the first things, I mean, the office is, it's like...
I don't think he means helpful to us. Do you mean helpful to us or helpful to the other presidents? I'm sorry. You interpreted it correctly. Forgive me.
But you can answer it anyway. You know, Clinton has a signed picture from Johnson from 40 years ago on the windowsill. And he points to the bookcase and he says, "There's my presidential library." And it's all histories and biographies and memoirs and diaries of presidents back as far as you can go. And at one point, I mean, in the conversation, he goes on this long thing about the poor trials of Franklin Pierce. You know, what was remarkable is how much they think of themselves as part of this club that actually includes all the presidents. You know, they all are obsessed with Abraham Lincoln. You know, Eisenhower didn't only buy his farm at Gettysburg, he would paint portraits of Lincoln and give them out as Christmas presents to people. So that, you know, to hear Clinton talk about not only what his experience was and the relationships he developed, but the larger demands of holding the office and what it does to you and what you need, I think really was clarifying for us. But you may have a different...
I think they were all helpful in their own way. And you know, Jimmy Carter was very revealing in his interview. So was Bush. And I think they talked among themselves. I know they talked among themselves about how cooperative they wanted to be. And I think they came to the conclusion that they would be.
And I think... happy about you writing this book?
I have no idea. Don't know. But I think they thought that it was a story to be told because it was in some ways indicative of where we could go if we could get our act together. So, yeah. Anyone else? Wait, we have one more.
I sort of believe we live in a different time. It's an over-the-top kind of time. And I'm personally wondering how we all are going to get through till November, much less how you perceive what this will do to the President's Club, because the animosity, the depth of feeling, and the destructiveness concerns me.
You want to take that one? That's an easy one.
Oh, well.
Oh, I know I asked for that. Okay. That's true. Yeah, I know you were. I don't worry so much about the coming election. I think Americans are actually pretty good at picking presidents. Yeah, I think they're pretty good at picking presidents. Well, people are also pretty good at disagreeing about whether we pick presidents. But I actually have a fair amount of confidence. One of the things I have, can I just go back a picture? This is my favorite picture. I'll tell you why. There's a way to answer the question. This week, the French elected a president, right? A new president. The French are famous for electing tall, elegant, grandfatherly, patrician, anti-American presidents. They inadvertently elected Sarkozy and kicked him out. But what was really striking to me about what the French normally do is they elect men who could have come originally all from the same club. One right after another, just like the others. We're not like that. The United States of America is not the American Kennel Club. We are a mongrel country full of all of us mutts. I have a German-Jewish grandfather and a Lutheran and a Catholic and a God knows what he was. And we're all kind of from 10 different places. And our presidents aren't like the French at all. There is no club all these people would have been a member of ever until they got elected president. And if you go back, you know, to include Reagan and Nixon and Johnson and Kennedy, it just gets weirder. And so the strength of the American system is that we don't have any sort of preconceived notions about who our leaders can be. Anyone can grow up to be president. And so after covering them as closely as I have for the last 30 years, I recognize that it's a strife-filled system we have. But I actually have a lot of confidence in the outcome. And I have a lot of confidence in the ability of the public to pick the next leader. So it's not pleasant to watch always. But I actually am fairly optimistic about the outcomes. I don't expect you to share that, but that's how I feel.
Thank you very much for, I know we have a deadline that we are on, and so, but we appreciate your coming. And of course, Michael, I have one question for you.
Mm-hmm.
Would this book be a better Mother's Day present or Father's Day?
It's really hard to say, Nancy. I think that will take a whole nother hour.
Michael Duffy and Nancy Gibbs, journalists and the authors of The President's Club, inside the world's most exclusive fraternity. They spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on May 11th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of their talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. Heidi Lang recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Focus Features, presenting Moonrise Kingdom, directed by Wes Anderson and starring Bruce Willis, Edward Norton, and Bill Murray, in select theaters now. Coming up to 9 o'clock, 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham. I'm Bill O'Grady. Some basic questions tomorrow night, like why is there something rather than nothing? Physicist Lawrence Krauss claims we may finally have an answer, though fellow physicist Marcelo Gleiser is skeptical. Copernicus changed the world with his revolutionary idea that the sun, not the earth, is the center of our solar system.